Welcome to Educated Conjecture, an Ipsos podcast that combines what the public thinks with what the experts think. Each week, Ipsos's Mike College and Sean Simpson are joined by an informed guest to discuss the issues of the day. More than 2 in 3 Canadians say they're worried that basic services have been neglected by our governments. In this episode, Mike and Sean are joined by Daryl Bricker, Global CEO, Ipsos Public Affairs, to discuss precarious public confidence, concerns about the delivery of public services, and a divided set of issues. And now, on to the episode.
Hello, all. Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm well, Mike.
We're going to do a couple quick summer hits with our friend, Dr. Daryl Bricker. How are you, Daryl?
Doing well, Mike.
Some people may know him.
Some people may know him better than they know us. He's better looking anyway. Daryl.
We're on radio, Mike. It doesn't matter.
We're on radio. It doesn't matter. Sean, we're basically deadlocked, maybe a slight liberal lead based on where we were, sort of where we were at the end of the last election. Not a lot of movement, despite the fact that we have a healthy, fairly loud campaign on the conservative side. People at least know what's going on. A lot more memberships have been sold. And on the flip side, nothing seems to have moved, despite the fact that we have a fairly, slumping economic numbers in a lot of our context.
Well, I was going to say, given that the Tories are leaderless, the Liberals should be in a relative position of strength, but it doesn't appear that they are. So perhaps that's a good segue to ask Daryl what he thinks. Why are the Liberals in a slump, in a malaise, and not able to capitalize on a rudderless Tory party at the moment?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, Sean. I think one of them is the context, as Mike correctly mentioned. Canadians are feeling very nervous at the moment, more nervous than we've seen them in quite some time. Although the negative trend in terms of public opinion relative to the overall environment and this government in particular has been around since at least just before the 2019 election. So they've not really had any strong public support, with the exception of a short period of time during the course of COVID. So they've gone back to basically where they were, except they've now got more cuts, bruises, scars, barnacles, however you want to talk about the wear and tear on the government. Much more wear and tear on themselves today than they did two and a half years ago when we started into this pandemic. So you can just feel the appetite for change existing out there in the population. Now, whether that actually amounts to anything, I mean, they've got to deal with the new Democrats that's going to get them through to the expected time period for the next election, which is about another 2.5 years away. But, the Tories are going to have a new leader in September. There might be an increasing level of pressure if the Tories can get some momentum behind their leadership for the Liberals to do something. I mean, the Liberal caucus will probably be anxious to see what their future is going to be. Do they actually see Justin Trudeau going in and trying to win a fourth election? Is he going to be Stephen Harper and try and do that? Or is he going to be his father and Brian Mulroney, who found a way to get out of there and to put somebody else in the position to try and win again, rather than face the voters one last time with poor political prospects?
And if the vote were held today, in terms of how people feel about direction of the country, we're about where we were at the pandemic. At the pandemic, we had 38% who said, only 38% say the country's going in the right direction. We're at 41% today. So 2 years of vaccines, economic growth, money poured into the economy in terms of supporting those who were, through CERB, hasn't really made people feel like we've turned the corner and heading in the right direction.
A couple hundred billion should buy you more points.
Should buy you a couple points.
Yeah.
it's interesting to see what's happened. I mean, we may be looking back at 2019 as the good old days. When you look back at the issue agenda that was facing the country back then, it was a very different issues agenda than the one that we see today. Then we had a whole series of important issues that people were focused on. Now they've been pushed out by urgent issues. First of all, it was the COVID pandemic, Now inflation, which is now obviously topping our most important issue polling, and also what we're seeing globally is the most important issue when we go out and we poll people. Healthcare is always going to be there, but this the fast-moving issue is inflation. So there's no opportunity for the sunny ways type of an approach that the Liberals had back in 2019 when they were, or 2000, how long have they been around? 2016 or whenever it was they were elected.
2015, yeah.
Yeah, when they were first elected, there's no way for them to put that in the window and have any sort of resonance with the Canadian public right now. So they're in a difficult set of circumstances. So the Conservatives are going to make their choice in September, and we'll stay tuned to see what kind of choice the Liberals are going to make about their future.
We just recently conducted some polling for Global News, and it was about the airport issue. And of course, the sort of sensational headline was that 7 in 10 Canadians are calling our situation a national embarrassment. But the more consequential, I would say, data coming from that is that two-thirds are worried that the airport travel issue is just the start of a bunch of problems with delivery of basic public services, and two-thirds believe that basic services like making sure our airports work have been neglected by our governments, which have been focused on the wrong issues for far too long. So, Daryl, you just said the issue agenda now looks very different from it from 2019. Does this mean that governments have not fully understood the dynamic nature of that issue agenda and aren't keeping up?
Yeah, I think they're just as surprised as the public is in some ways about the fact that things that everybody was taking for granted actually require some leadership, some preparation, and some effort. But it also shows how fragile some of these systems are. I mean, you could also add in, the Rogers blackout for 2 days as another example of this. And these are the kinds of things that shake the confidence of the public. I mean, when Jimmy Carter back in the, and you guys are too young to remember this, Mike might be a little older, I might remember it, talked about the malaise that was in the United States.
43 years ago.
Yeah, you know, the public doesn't want to hear that. You know, you're in charge, do something.
But I think it's a message. I mean, I know, I think it's a message that someone's going to have to say there's a reality is we need to fix some things, right? And I know healthcare is a perennial issue, but we're seeing healthcare a perennial issue. It stayed at the top. It's rising amongst seniors, those who are most likely to use it. We know from previous work we did decades ago that it'll eventually, it ties to economics, it ties to a range of things. But at the same time as we're seeing it up there, we're actually seeing the premier starting to do what they did before, and that's line up and say it's the federal government's issue and you're going to have to pony up. We're not going to come to a table unless we have some discussion around it. And we're starting to see throughout Canada emergency rooms shut down, or emergency rooms that aren't open after 6 p.m. And I think that that's going to start to that's one issue that when the service starts to drop off, people will be like, okay, we've hit a tipping point, I think. So we'll see.
I think, guys, that public confidence in a lot of things is very precarious right now. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book that came out in 2001 called Searching for Certainty that I wrote with Ed Greenspan, and I think the title was more appropriate to today than it was even back when the book came out, because that's what you're finding now in the public opinion environment. People don't know what they can count on, and so when you start seeing things that relate to basic services like airports, the digital network in the country, passports, hospital emergency rooms, any number of things that have been coming out over the last while as being problematic, people are asking questions about whether or not they can rely on their public institutions to be able to deliver the things that they count on. And, particularly when they look at what they pay for in taxes, when they look at the level of affordability, the challenge that they're now facing these days, there's going to be some hard questions that are going to be asked of governments. Now, the happiest people around are probably the Ford government in the province of Ontario that, lined up a majority just before we started to see all of these things really start to dig in. I mean, all the fumes were in the air, but it wasn't really coming together as one consolidated kind of explosive type of an environment. So they went past it a little bit, but there may be some other governments that get caught up in this. I mean, here in the province of Ontario, where I am today, and the two of you are, We're going to be facing some major municipal elections coming up in the fall. One wonders if some of those mayors are going to start to be under, and city councils are going to be under some pressure on some of these questions and issues. We're in a very precarious, fragile public opinion environment.
I think we're also in a much more divided, in terms of not necessarily divided, well, we are, but divided set of issues, right? There isn't two or three issues that cover 70% of the population. Cost of living inflation, perhaps. But it's very different, right? If you're 28 years old, your cost of living worries are still about housing and can get in the market. And if you're 50 and on a fixed income and looking at trying to figure out how to retire, it's a different set of issues than if you're 65 and have a pension. So I don't think there's a consensus on how we tackle some of those things. And that when you get down a level into climate change or into a range of other issues that are not on the top level of urgency, we get pretty wide swings in which demographic groups are most supportive in what they want to do and where they want to move.
You know, one of the things that is a standard hypothesis about the future is that there is going to be a considerable amount of generational infighting. So you've got people, and it's for listeners to understand this, usually the way that people, this is presented is that, you know, young people against old people. Well, it's not really that. I mean, when you take a look at the data, what you see is that it's actually people, you know, a bit older plus younger people. So people in their 50s, Gen X, you know, tail end baby boomers, and then everybody else following on that who are feeling like, you know, they're not going to get what they thought their life was going to be. They're not going to be able to live in the house that they thought they were going to be able to live in the neighborhood they thought they're going to be able to live in. They're not going to be able to retire in comfort as they thought they might be able to. A whole series of anticipated benefits for life success aren't going to be coming their way, which puts a challenge on the situation for the middle class. It's kind of a standard trope that there's going to be the younger against the older. I'm starting to think as to whether or not being upset with the lack of institutional delivery by people, for example, like our governments, and in some instances, some of our major businesses in this country, is actually going to unite people against what they would perceive as elites. And it's not defined in any sort of generational way, but people who are in decision-making situations or are sitting on top of large organizations that are supposed to be, are usually well compensated and are supposed to be delivering on behalf of the population, whether the population is going to start uniting against some of these institutions that people are increasingly questioning their ability to deliver. I'm not sure which one it is. I think they're two interesting hypotheses, but we'll have to see how it plays out.
How much blame do you think Canadians ascribe to our government when it comes to the economic situation with inflation and all the resulting consequences of that? I mean, are they giving them a bit of a free pass because of COVID, because of Ukraine and all of these things? Or do you believe that Canadians think we should be in a better position than we are?
It really doesn't matter what I believe. It's what the data say. And the data say that Canadians, and we've seen this in the global data too. I was just at the UN and in Geneva talking about the global data on this. And what we're seeing on inflation is people aren't really sure who to blame. So all of the things that you could point to, they're prepared to blame. They're prepared to blame the war in Ukraine. They're prepared to blame the global economy. They're prepared to blame the policies of their own government. They're prepared to blame the pandemic. But the truth is, there's only one group that they can really take action against, and that's organizations in their own countries. So regardless of how they blame things, the place where their anxiety will reside or will come to rest is in their own country. And the electoral system is the way that we normally deal with this. But there's opportunities for other types of protests. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in the Ipsos Disruption Barometer is that there's a lot of countries out there that are just tinderboxes. Canada's not quite a tinderbox type situation, but it's difficult to see how things could go off. Or it's difficult to define exactly what it is that will set things off. But I think some of these service things could be it.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at sort of the inflation causes. As you mentioned, Daryl, supply change or global geopolitical issues. But not too far down the list are national policies and excessive profits, both of which people can squarely tie back to their own country and say, you know, the people who are I'm paying for services are getting too much, and the country doesn't have the right national policies to weather this storm. So they'll find a way to make it domestic.
It's the only way you can act, right?
Yeah.
So and it's a good point that you brought that up, Mike. One of the big issues that we're seeing in our polling is excessive profits for organizations, for businesses that are in positions of advantage right now, given what's going on with, say, for example, the price of energy and other players. They are very likely targets for government action.
Yeah, I think we see it in the fall. We see a more concerted effort. I mean, they telegraphed it pretty clearly in the NDP Liberal discussions, but I think we'll see a picked up in the fall a discussion that this is something we can do, will be at the national stance. You know, we the creative policies to get us out of it might be forthcoming down the road, but we can actually start to find money to move around.
Many have said, Daryl, that climate change is the defining issue of our time. Is it getting squeezed out of the conversation now or pushed down the priority agenda because of all of these other problems that seem to have arisen over the last 2 years?
I think climate is a classic example of the important being pushed down by the urgent or being blocked out by the urgent. And that's what we're seeing right now. First, it was COVID, and now it's switched over to inflation and economic anxiety. And as a result of that, climate, which seems like people are obviously concerned about it. There's a lot of climate news that's happening as we're taping this. I mean, the record temperatures in Europe and other things that are happening. It's certainly in the news, but it's in the news. And for Canadians, it's not necessarily directly in their lives, but they're opening up their monthly, their monthly bills. If they still get them through the mail or they get them online, and they're seeing how much the price of things are going up. Particularly if they have a mortgage and they're renegotiating their interest rates, or they've gone out to fill up their car in order to be able to start commuting to work again, and they're getting some real sticker shock. So that's the kind of thing that's really personal. It's when they're actually engaged in the issue, they're actually being affected directly by the issue. It's not something, that's at the top of making, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs of making the world a better place. It's, more in the lower end of it, which is more related to survival. And I think that's what's happening with Canadians right now. Their horizon has gotten very short. Their focus has become very personal and very much related to what's going on in their households. And while they will acknowledge that something needs to be done about climate, this second, it's other issues that are preoccupying.
Even if they did want to do something, they most don't know what to do. The literacy on personal solutions is very low. And so you get people saying, I'm going to recycle, which is great, but doesn't necessarily help with climate change. And you're right, Daryl, it's pretty clear from all of our data that as soon as it becomes a quality of life issue, which they already think is in decline, or an income to spend issue, which they already think is going to decline. If you add climate change adaption in and say you'll have less, people go, well, no, that's not how this is going to work. Right in this moment, I can't afford it. I think, what are we, 23%, Sean, who say that they're tapped out completely? I don't have any room at all.
Yeah.
To take on new costs. And yet, we had the interest rates go up a full point last week. Now, that doesn't affect everybody right away, particularly if your mortgage isn't coming up yet. But as 83% of Canadians say, every time I see more stories about inflation or interest rates going up, I assume a recession's coming. The strange thing is they're saying all this, but yet they're spending. Right. So we're in this sort of strange position right now where they're putting it off. And we see some indication from young people that they're going, it doesn't really matter. Government's going to bail us out, and I'll just live for today.
I guess you can get into that that type of, it's almost like anarchy. Right?
Yeah.
When you're not thinking about what the situation is, anomie, I just feel everything is pointless, and I might as well just, go for it. It's almost a millenarian type of perspective. The world is going to end, so I might as well party today.
Might as well rack up my credit card.
Yeah, but the problem is, as we've noted, is you might have that at one end, but that now you're going to get people if this sustains itself for a longer period of time. And we see things like property values start to come down. People with big mortgages with lower levels of property value, that's a problem. And if the real estate market, in which the Canadian economy is so dependent, starts to become very tenuous, it's been overheated over the space of the last couple of years. And by the way, government institutions haven't really been able to do anything about it. But if it starts to go in the other direction, there's a lot of people who are sitting smugly on the side here with large property values that they think that they're going to be able to cash in at some point, where that starts to become become less likely. So there's a very, very difficult period, we're about to go into. And you can just see, as people are kind of halfway across the lake, you can start to see the cracks forming in the ice, and they're worried about whether or not they're going to fall in. And the cracks keep getting wider and longer, and the sound of the cracking keeps getting louder. And you're seeing the public reacting to that.
Complicated discussion about energy transition. While they're panicking about they can't feed their family, yeah. Right? Or can't get a mortgage that can keep them in their house. And then we say we want to have a discussion about how we're going to transition energy for the next 20 years. So
yeah, and being tone deaf, I think, is one of the things that our governments are going to have to be very careful of. I saw a very senior politician who will be completely unnamed, quoted heard clips from him. And so we know at least it's a him at an event here in Toronto, going on about issues that sounded very 2019 about inclusivity and all this kind of stuff, making the world a better place. And it was like, do you realize people are just desperate to be back together? Like, why are you such a wet blanket? Mm. Why are you going to, like, this is your thing? And it just seemed like he didn't realize that this world is in a different place, and that the things that you said that sounded really good a couple of years ago may not sound so good today. It can sound like you're kind of missing the point. I think politicians are going to have to be really careful, because that ice is thinner than they think it is, I think, in some instances.
Especially since on that one, not that there aren't problems in the country, but most people feel diversity is a good thing. Immigration is a good thing. None of that's waned. The worry always when the economy turns is that we'll turn on others. And that doesn't seem to be showing up in our data so far. In fact, it's held very strong. Their economic health is down. People's sentiment is down. But when we ask, is diversity a good thing for the country? People are absolutely rock solid, around 83%, I think.
Yeah, well, it is interesting. I as I said before, the trope is the position is that what we're going to be seeing is generational conflict. And we may, that may very well happen. But in the short term, I'm wondering if anger towards, institutional performance is going to actually unite people. And, who this benefits, and, if the election was being held tomorrow, is probably the potential new leader of the Conservative Party, federally, Pierre Poilievre, because this is like right on his sweet spot. This is exactly what he's talking about, the gatekeepers. It's easier to kind of create something that's a faceless institution that everybody should get together, should get behind challenging, than it is to say, hey, young people, you should be opposed to old people, or old people, you should be opposed to young people. People don't hate their neighbors, they don't hate their parents, and they don't hate their kids. But you can make them pretty upset about an institution, and maybe Poilievre's onto something.
So this disconnect here between what Canadians think is important and what our leaders seem to be championing or paying more attention to, is that a Trudeau government problem? Is it a Liberal government problem? Is it a seven-year-old government problem? Is it a problem that all governments face? Where on that scale would you put this?
It is a very particular problem for the Trudeau government, because their DNA is that 2015, I think the election was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that 2015 DNA? Sunny ways, Canada's back, all that kind of stuff. The light in comparison to the darkness that existed before. And the problem is that they're looking these days like an old neon light sign with a whole bunch of the bulbs smashed out. They're not. It's not the way that it was. So they are in a situation in which maybe they can look brighter in comparison to something darker, if that's if that's the position that they take relative to Polyev, maybe they'll be able to do that, or maybe they need to find some new bulbs. So, the big question for me going forward is not what the Conservatives are going to do. I mean, I've seen no evidence that suggests that any other leader other than Pierre Polyev is going to win this leadership. The next question is what's going to happen with the Liberals. That's the really interesting question. And one of two paths. He's either Justin Trudeau is either his father and Brian Mulroney, and they decide to avoid the day of reckoning, or he's going to go down swinging like Stephen Harper did. I'm not sure which one it's going to be. I don't think anybody is. I don't think maybe he doesn't even know
if it'll be on his own accord or if there will be too much pressure from within the party ranks.
I don't think, honestly, Sean, that it will be pressure from the party ranks. The checks and balances in the Liberal Party that used to exist, basically the Justin Trudeau version, threw them over the side of the boat the minute that they got control of the oars on the ship. There's enough mixed metaphors for you there. but as soon as they took over, so those normal like party grandees and people from the Chrétien era, the Paul Martin era, or whatever, they're all out. These are all people who are really highly dependent on Justin Trudeau, and they got elected because of Justin Trudeau back in 2015. They've struggled with him over the last two elections, but it's very much his party. I don't see that there's anything that pushes him out. And unlike Jean Chrétien, where Paul Martin, was his frenemy through the entire time that government was in power and ended up getting fired by Jean Chrétien as a result of disloyalty, and rightfully so, he was disloyal. You don't see any of that in the Liberal Party right now. So Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister, is just as involved and engaged and affected by the reputation of the Liberal Party as he is, as Prime Minister Trudeau is. So to the extent that she will be able to position herself as some sort of a difference or as a challenge inside the party, difficult to see.
How much do you think Del Duca in Ontario wore the previous government's record into this last election? And you just mentioned Chrystia. I mean, everybody at the table, the Liberal cabinet table federally, is part of the team going forward.
Yeah, there might be people who are sort of further down the list that may be able to say that they were part of it, but not so much part of it that they couldn't change. But it's difficult to see where the difference is between Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland. I mean, it's just, and this was the problem with Paul Martin. I mean, that he had, even though he had the big difference between him and Jean Chrétien and got fired, when the ad scam came up and the Gomery inquiry came up and all the issues in Quebec came up, what he asked the public to accept was one of two propositions. Either he was, completely disengaged and didn't know what was going on, or he wasn't telling the truth. Chrystia Freeland doesn't even have that going for her. She was probably, she's been completely engaged in this all the way along. So she has to be able to run if Justin Trudeau doesn't on the record of the government. And just like Brian Mulroney was in a position where, he wasn't able to do anything with that record, and Kathleen Wynne inevitably was not able to, she was able to do it for one term with Dalton McGuinty's record, but ultimately it's what brought her down. Do you see Justin Trudeau being able to combat that himself? Well, Pierre Polyev, who knows how he's going to perform? Maybe it creates the opportunity, but I don't think most politicians sit around and worry, sit around and hope for the other person to fail in order for them to win. They usually like to feel they're in a position to be able to put up a good fight. So, we'll see where it goes. But I think the most interesting story of to the end of this year and the beginning of next year is what is Justin Trudeau going to do?
Shifting gears for a sec, same context, but for corporate C-suites who have progressively, pardon the pun, over the last few years weighed in on social issues, whether it was Black Lives Matter, diversity, climate change, now that's an economic issue, but started to get more involved in what were traditionally seen as government spaces. Pretty easy when, they're all on one side and everybody's for something, but as we move into a down and changing, do they retrench a little bit and stick to their financial performance and good service and say, go quiet? Or do they hold on to that ground where, no, we have a role in society that's broader than financial performance and client service?
Well, I think their job just got a whole lot harder. Because I think the very basics of being able to run a business these days, with all the supply chain issues and the financial issues that are going to be created by inflation, and the demographic change issues that are going to be created for the workforces, and other things that are going on right now, are going to challenge them on the very, very basic aspects of running a successful business and keeping their customers happy. But now that the whole ESG area has been opened up, and companies have said that they're going to be part of this, they're going to actually have to be able to do both. What's the emphasis going to be on the short term? Maybe a little less on ESG, but it's not like somebody should be sitting back saying, I can just ditch that stuff now, and I can go back to just trying to please my shareholders and please my primary clients, and that's going to be it. No, there's no such thing as the private sector anymore. Private sector is part of this, and as a result of that, now that they've moved down that path with ESG, and many companies have embraced it, it's very, very difficult to back for them in terms of their financial performance or their loyalty of their customers or whatever. This is still something that I think researchers are working hard to figure out what the relationship is between this and customer loyalty. But taking it away, or making a mistake on it, exposes you to people being able to point a finger at you and saying you're not being a good corporate citizen. They've raised expectations and they've raised stakes around this. So I think it's going to be very difficult for them to just easily pivot off to just running a business like you were back in 1975. I don't think that's going to happen anymore. You're going to have to be able to do both.
And I get the feeling from our social cohesion work that where people would have said, I'm glad that you're doing something for Canada, whether it's on youth issues or climate change. But now I would like to know what you're doing for me. There's a little more pointed in it, or at least in my backyard. That's great that you're helping young entrepreneurs, but I don't see them near me, if that's the angle they're taking. People are getting a little more me in there in some of our data, which is worrisome.
Well, Mike, as we tell our people in the our clients in the public sector, all politics is local. So if you're going to go play a political game and you're a corporation, guess what? All politics is local.
Yeah, it's an excellent point.
Indeed. Daryl, I have one last question for you. I was just scanning our list of top 10 issues from What Worries the World, and we touched on it, but we peripherally, but COVID-19, it's still here. We're in, what is this, the seventh wave now, or eighth anyway. What do you think the public appetite is for reinstating restrictions, whether it be changing the definition of what it means to be vaccinated, whether it's reinstituting mask mandates or travel mandates for unvaccinated? What's your sense as to what levers the government still has within its ability or control to use?
Well, as you're seeing with almost every government in the world, with the exception of China, they've realized that essentially everything has become voluntary. It's very, very difficult to go back to things that we would have considered to be, acceptable back in March 2020, through that summer period. And the reason is because people have lived with COVID now. Many, 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 many people have had COVID. Many people have gotten over COVID. Many people are vaccinated. Many people are, living with this experience. And as they get more used to existing in this type of an environment, the less willing they are to look just to public authorities to govern their behavior. And so what's happening is, regardless of how I would say trivial it seems to say, the term new normal, we have a new normal that's starting to emerge and has emerged in other jurisdictions faster than it has in Canada, which is that we expect everybody to kind of be on their best behavior, and everybody's going to govern themselves accordingly. And they're not looking to the public institutions as much as they were to guide what the situation is going to be. And it's getting harder and harder and harder for public institutions to, impose their will related to COVID on the public. And it's just simply the performance of the disease that's made it possible for the public to say, I'm going to make up my own mind on most of this stuff. We see it in our own data when we go out and we ask people, whether or not they're going to pursue a fourth booster shot. And you just see the numbers just drop off on every one of these things. And the reason is because they sit back and they say, you know, it's just going to be around. And as a result, when we look at what are the most important issues facing the country today and what are the most important issues facing the world, when we ask it globally, you can see almost a one-to-one replacement between inflation and COVID. COVID's dropping like a stone as inflation shoots up. It's almost like a counterweight, COVID like a counterweight. And inflation is just moving up incredibly fast. And people just aren't dealing with it the way that they were. If there's a new thing that happens in which a lot of people get sick and get really sick, I think we could go back, but not in the current environment, not what we're seeing with the new variants, not with what we're seeing happening everywhere else in the world.
I think you're right. Right now, it's not an issue. It's a factor in other issues. So it feeds the healthcare issue. Yeah. It feeds the inflation issue. It feeds a number of other issues. It's a factor in why inflation is rising and those kind of things.
Or in research terms, no longer the dependent variable.
Exactly. If I was a researcher,
It's not the dependent variable. It's moved to an independent variable.
Correct.
That's what Mike is saying. But the other thing is the more governments, I think, raise it as an explanation, the more it sounds like an excuse.
Yeah.
And I think that increasingly over time, that's what you're going to see is governments stand up and say, hey, we've got inflation. We've got these problems. We can't do this. We can't do that. And the public's going to say, okay, you're like, I get it. It's a factor, but you've had time. It's like Rogers a couple of weeks ago trying to suggest that some of this was related to the pandemic. No, it wasn't related to the pandemic. You can't really blame everything on the pandemic. It's like you can't blame everything on climate change. Right?
Well, and it's just a little bit like politicians always blame the government before them, right? Then you find yourself 6-7 years later blaming the government before you something that was decided 4 years ago.
The Trudeau government can't really blame the Harper government for anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and anymore. Harper blamed Chrétien forever, right?
Yeah.
So at some point, people turn and they say, as leaders, we expect you to take the credit when it's good, but you need to take some of the fall when it's down. So,
well, and that's also why when they start hearing the explanations like, oh, it's a global thing, it's external, profit taking by corporations and all the rest of it, the public sort of turns around and says, okay, what's your role here? Because you're the people I elect to deal with this stuff. You're in the captain's seat, the driver's seat. You're flying this plane. If I don't like what's going on, you're the person to talk to, and you're the person I'm going to blame. So I think it's going to make for a very interesting fall and second quarter of next year.
I think that
Pierre Poilievre taking over as leader of the Conservative Party just might be one shoe.
Excellent. Well, Daryl, thank you. I knew this was going to happen. For those of you who are going to listen at home, we set out to record a couple of quick 2-3 minute segments, and 45 minutes later. And this is what happened whenever Daryl and I talk. So
we should also mention, I thought you were going to get teary-eyed there for a minute, Mike, because it's our anniversary. Well, it's not an anniversary, but a milestone. It's our 25th episode, isn't it?
And
that's why we wanted Dr. Bricker to come on and impart some of his wisdom.
Well, I'm happy to. You can, anybody listening, you can decide if it's wisdom or if it's something else. And it usually emerges from a field of cows. But congratulations, guys.
Thanks. Cheers, all.
Take care. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Educated Conjecture. Follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts for another episode of Public Opinion and Informed Insights. If you have a topic you'd like to see covered on an upcoming episode, please send us an email at publicaffairs@ipsos.com. That's publicaffairs@ipsos.com.